Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
And welcome to selected highlights of our live Q&A event on refugees and asylum seekers, recorded in the Open House studios, Sunday evening, August 31, 2014. Our live studio audience peppered our panel of guests with at times some very challenging questions on community expectations, government leadership, and the possibility of alternative options for the millions around the world identified as refugees. Our panellists included the Honourable Philip Ruddock, MP, Chief Government Whip and Federal Member for Barara, former Minister for Immigration and Multicultural Affairs from 1996 to 2003, and Attorney General 2003 to 2007. The Reverend Dr. Michael Jensen, Rector of St. Mark's, Darling Point, Sydney, theologian and author of My God, Is It Possible to Believe Anymore? And Pieces of Eternity. Greg Lake, former Immigration Detention Centre Manager, including Nauru, Christmas Island, Curtin in WA and Sugar in Queensland. And Katie Wrigley, Principal Solicitor at the Refugee Advice and Casework Service, RACS for short, an organisation that provides legal assistance to people seeking refugee status in Australia. Our first inquisitor, Vicky.
My question is for the Honourable Philip Ruddock. How were you able to effectively stop the boats when you were the Minister for Immigration, and how has the situation changed over the years?
We were dealing with it in much the same way the Labor Party had. Gerry Hand had been the Minister, mandatory detention was there. What we saw was a continuing increase in the number of people being brought to Australia. And the question was, how do you deal with it, particularly when we thought we were dealing with Tampa? And Tampa was really the key to it. We found that there were, whatever it was, 350 people rescued at sea on a vessel that took them on board, and it was agreement with Indonesia that they would be taken to Merak, the Indonesian port, and that was where they'd left, and that's the direction in which the vessel was going. And however you describe it, they effectively stood over the captain, and even though it wasn't in their commercial interest, they brought the vessel off Christmas Island and said, you take them. I have to say, I was just a humble minister. There was a prime minister who took an interest in it, and he took the view that we should not be stood over by people saying, well, you know, you've been saved, but we insist that you take us to Australia and not to Indonesia. And so there was a standoff, and that brought about the process of taking people offshore for management purposes. So there was an agreement with Nauru that they would go there and they'd be processed there. We worked with the UNHCR and we agreed to a processing arrangement, and we put in place arrangements for people to be properly assessed. We had some arrangements with New Zealand that some folk would go there. We had arrangements that those who were found not to be refugees would go home. And in the end, a smaller part, but a proportion of them, were brought to Australia. We took a view also at that time that we should start to turn back boats where we could. I always took the view that you had offshore processing, you had temporary protection visas, which had been introduced. I suspect that the biggest impact probably was turning back boats, because we know from intelligence work that was done in Indonesia that many of the people who went back went after the smugglers and said, we want our money back. And when the smugglers found that they had people coming after them, they went to ground. They essentially took themselves out of the business. That had a very, very significant impact.
Philip Ruddock, there was a great deal of press coverage about that process. Yes, a great deal. And you as a minister, as well as ministers around you, were always very open and candid about what was going on the water. How do you feel about the secrecy that surrounds the way we are dealing with those boats now? And if part of the message should be that we are finding these boats and turning them around, and that we are open and candid about that equation, how do you feel about that process?
Do you want me in one of my mischievous moods again? It's very interesting. I was accused of putting into the public arena that children had been thrown overboard. I don't know whether you remember that.
Clearly.
Don't know whether you remember that. But, you know, I was the culprit. And how did it happen? I was briefed by officials who had been told by Navy that people were seen throwing their children overboard. That was a Navy report. Came to senior officials, was given to me. And I took the view that I should be open. I'd been told by my officials that this had happened. I was going into a press conference to discuss a whole lot of other issues about 4 or 5 weeks before an election. Do I sit on it, knowing it, and have journalists come to me and say, Ruddock, why were you hiding these things from us? And I came to a view it was better to go public. And in the end, it was seen to have been wrong because the advice that Navy had given was wrong. Navy had seen children held over the side of the boat. They'd seen people in the water, and the captain assumed the people in the water were the children. But later, they found out they weren't. So there has been a view, and you'll find it in the comments of Labor ministers who would frequently refuse to talk about issues because they wanted to be satisfied that they would be able to be properly and fully briefed and that investigations had occurred which would enable you to substantiate what you were in fact saying. So I would say that a lot of the management of this process in relation to operations that are current is designed to ensure that people accurately find out what is happening and talk about it at a time when they're in a position to properly inform you.
Michael Jansen.
If I may, Mr. Rudden, with respect, the I don't want to malign your motives at all, but the effect of that was certainly in the community a great alarm and horror at what, you know, the kind of appalling kind of people. It was a dehumanising effect of that. Of that comment, which actually turned out to be, as you know, you were not to know, etc., turned out to be not the case, and so that's kind of that's been unfortunately part of the scene, hasn't it? That piece of information got out in such a way as to horrify the Australian public, which kind of suited the election process at the time.
I know. Let me make it very clear. It was not engineered.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying
it happened in the way in which I described. Navy told the committee that was dealing with these issues in Canberra. I was briefed by Des Storer, who was the official in the department at that time who had responsibility to tell me.
Yeah, my point is not the engineering so much as the fact that, in one sense, the politicians, they can do what they like. It's that the community itself responded to that piece of information with the kind of alarm and horror in such a way as it dehumanised those people, both people. That's not your responsibility necessarily, but it says something about the Australian psyche, which I find quite alarming.
There was an investigation in relation to these matters, and my conduct was found to be.
But I think that's not. Yeah, found, I'm not.
Was not the subject of any criticism.
Yeah, but I'm not.
The point I make is that it does go to this question as to whether or not ministers should be talking about these issues before they have fully been briefed and all of the appropriate inquiries have been undertaken to have established exactly what is happening.
Katie Reedley, one question.
Well, I think the Senate inquiry that followed the Tampa used the phrase blatant government manipulation of the armed forces, the public service and asylum seekers. And I think that phrase flows from the fact that a month before the 2001 election, the government released those images, the media reports of asylum seekers throwing their children from a boat in protest at being boarded and shipped out of Australian territory, and the fact that was allowed to be the image, and that's what the Australian public were allowed to see in terms of the SAS boarding the Norwegian freighter Tampa, taking control of a non-Australian ship, and with the Australian Navy escorting it out of Australian waters. So I take issue with the idea that there was no government manipulation throughout that process when that's what the Senate inquiry that followed clearly said took place.
Yeah, well, Senate inquiries have other motives. There were formal inquiries undertaken to look at whether or not there was any wrongdoing on the part of ministers and the officials that were dealing with these issues, and my recollection is that they were exonerated, as I was. But, look, the point I would make is that it doesn't in any way derogate from the point, and I think it reinforces the point when you add the additional information that you do, that you should not be talking about these issues until all the facts have been appropriately ascertained, and you can talk about it in a way which is properly informed.
We need to move on. I know, Greg, you'd love to leap in there, but we're running quickly short of time in this hour. Could we go to Zoe from Epping?
My question is, has the government's current policy worked in truly stopping the boats, or has it just stopped the boats from arriving in Australia?
Philip Ruddock.
Well, look, I'd only make the point. I mean, I have been privy to advice. I don't know whether I should source it, but my understanding is the numbers of people in Indonesia that might have been seeking to engage with smugglers have been coming off, and coming off quite significantly. People have come to a view that they're not going to succeed in coming to Australia in this way, and they're leaving Indonesia. And in my view, that's not a bad thing. If they have bona fide claims and are in urgent need of a resettlement place, my view is they should go to the UNHCR, and Australia, as one of the generous resettlement countries, would be willing to look at their places. But I suspect that for many, the wait is a very long wait, and there is a degree of uncertainty. And if they thought that by engaging a smuggler, they would be advantaged, people do. Now, my view is that by managing the borders in the way in which we have, we've brought that to an end, and we can resume being a generous resettlement country and an exemplar to the rest of the world about how you could help. And I would like to see... Look, a lot of people don't realise most European countries don't have resettlement programs. It's only the Scandinavian countries. The United States and Canada... I was interested recently that the French have agreed to take some people from Iraq, but it's the first time that that has happened. I used to talk to people like David Blunkett, who was the Minister of Home Affairs in the UK, and say, you shouldn't be talking about managing your borders unless you have a refugee program, which is taking people for resettlement. And he was the first British minister who agreed to look at those issues, but they don't have a substantial program for resettlement. I think Australia has been an exemplar, and Australians should be proud of what we have been able to do.
Greg Lake, you look like you're fit to burst, my friend. We have a question for you. Steph from Roseville.
Greg, are there other ways of undermining the business model of people smugglers that don't involve deterrence measures like offshore processing that cause spiritual, physical and emotional harm to the people that are seeking asylum here?
Absolutely, although I don't think that's easy. So I think the reality is this approach that's been taken has worked. And I don't subscribe to the view that a whole bunch of people are getting on boats and trying to get to Australia, but they're being turned around and we just don't hear about it. I do think it's interesting. I know you told me not to say anything, but I do think it's interesting that it took 3 weeks and a high court hearing before Scott Morrison was confident enough in his information to come up with a statement about the 157 asylum seekers. That concerns me that it takes a high court hearing before he'll admit that he has information sufficient to put on the public record. I think the idea of people smugglers is a complicated one. Some people smugglers are effectively a division of international organised crime, and this is a business opportunity. And so when that business opportunity dries up, they'll close up shop there and go back to their work with international arms trades and people trafficking in other areas. Usually the people who the asylum seekers you mentioned, Mr. Ruddock, go back to and say, oh, look, we've been returned to Indonesia. We want our money back. The people they're going to are the flunkies, the lowest of the low, the bottom of the food chain, a part of a much broader crime syndicate. And I think that's incredibly challenging for governments like Australia, who have also on many fronts are working against these very organisations. But I do think the easiest way to do it is to focus on those counterterrorism, international and organised crime strategies, and at the same time provide people who've left their country and who can't sit and wait in a refugee camp somewhere with an alternative to a boat. So I think it's nice to think that of the 51.2 million asylum seekers, refugees and displaced persons in the world, they're all the same. I think everybody would acknowledge they're not. And some of them run and can't stop. For those people who come towards Australia, we need to provide those alternatives. And if we do it effectively, the people smugglers will go back to their other business.
An online question from Rebecca. At least in spirit, if not technically, current immigration policies breach the Refugee Convention, the Convention Against Torture and the Convention on the Rights of the Child, for instance. What's the government justification for breaching these international laws? Philip Ruddock.
I don't believe the government is breaching its convention obligations. I've not seen any advice that suggests that that is true.
Katie Wrigley?
There'd be a number of ways that we would say the government is likely to be at risk of breaching its international obligations at the moment, including risk of refoulement, so sending refugees back to places where they're at risk of persecution, offshore processing, the conditions there have been described by UNHCR, Amnesty, other groups that have visited as likely to be breaching our international obligations. Screening is a process which is happening at the moment, so a person is interviewed for a very short period of time, just half an hour, to work out whether or not they have claims for protection before deciding whether or not to admit them to Australia or not. We have serious concerns about that half-hour process being enough time to find out whether someone is actually a refugee. I think in relation to a number of the comments that we've heard, apart from that, there's general detention plus human rights abuses, but in relation to are we stopping the boats at the moment, do we know if we're stopping the boats at the moment, I just wanted to make a comment on that. So I guess insofar as the Pacific solution was previously successful in stopping the number of asylum seekers reaching Australia or from leaving Indonesia by boat, it's clear that that package of policies did reduce the number of boat arrivals reaching Australia for those years. But I have a number of problems with the idea that that was a successful policy overall. Firstly, in fact, most asylum seekers recognised as refugees who were sent to Nauru and Manus were ultimately resettled in Australia because third countries couldn't be found to settle them in. Indonesia found itself burdened with thousands of asylum seekers that it regarded as Australia's problem and which may be seeking asylum now as a result. I think the costs of that policy, the fiscal, the human and the social, outweighed any gains that were made as a result of that policy. So until we find durable solutions, I'd echo what Greg said, in that we need to look at what's actually going to fix that problem in terms of looking beyond containment measures to work out how we can best stop the boats on a long-term basis.
Well, let me just say, I would always be happy to look at durable solutions, but what I've found is that most people abroad think that the problem is ours. The only people who've ever been prepared to share part of the burden have been the New Zealanders, who are always worried that people might be getting on boats and going further. And for me, I would love there to be the sort of regional approach that was taken in relation to Vietnam. Yeah. The United States helped, Canada helped, France helped, but I tell you, none of the countries who would otherwise resettle people see this as a burden-sharing role for them. They see it as our problem.
But how can we expect other countries, or why should we expect the main burden of assisting the world's asylum seekers to fall entirely to some of the world's poorest countries? Why shouldn't we play our part in assessing?
Well, I agree we should. That's why I believe very strongly in a structured refugee resettlement program to take people from many of these places where they're in immediate danger and have no prospect of being able to return home.
Which brings us
the very argument right from the beginning as to why I believe very strongly that we ought to be getting those people who need the help most.
You're listening to selected highlights of our live Q&A on refugees and asylum seekers, recorded in the Open House Studios on Sunday evening, August 31, 2014. Our panel included the Honourable Philip Ruddock MP, Chief Government Whip and a former Immigration and Multicultural Affairs Minister, the Reverend Dr. Michael Jensen, Rector of St. Mark's, Darling Point in Sydney, a theologian and author, Greg Lake, former Immigration Detention Centre Manager on sites including Nauru, Christmas Island, Curtin and Sugar, and Katie Wrigley, Principal Solicitor at the Refugee Advice and Casework Service, RACS for short. Here's Tom from Lilyfield.
Earlier on tonight, Mr. Ruddock brought up the example of the Good Samaritan. And as we read the Bible, we get a clear picture that for those who follow Jesus, there is a call to welcome the stranger. So in light of that, what should an authentic Christian response to asylum seekers and refugees look like? And how can this play out in policy?
Michael Jensen.
I prefer the word grace to compassion because it's distinctively Christian. And it comes from the cross, right? In the cross, which should drive everything we think about as Christians, we see that God makes space for even for his enemies, for people who are not like him, for people who are, in fact, his enemies, as we all are. And so as Christians, I think we've grasped grace. We know that what we have, we don't deserve. And so that should really permeate our discussion here. Not a question of kind of maintaining what we have or a kind of defensiveness. There should be an openness. The second thing I think for Christians is to get busy on the ground and to do what I know many Christians do, visiting refugees, welcoming refugees and asylum seekers into their own homes, providing them with things they don't have. It's extraordinary the kind of quiet grace that is distributed amongst the community. If you just care to dig and look a little bit, it's extraordinary what Christians people are doing. And a marked contrast from the situation of the treatment of Christians in Iraq to the treatment of many Muslims in Australia by Christians, I think, and we ought to keep doing that. Then I think the third thing is, of course, we need to be in conversation with our politicians. I'm the first to say that this whole situation is complicated and fraught, and policy is difficult, and we ought to be in prayer for our politicians as they do this. That's one of the chief things we ought to do as Christians, and letting our politicians know that we're praying for them as well. But also saying, look, guys, grace ought to inform this discussion, and especially, can we have a better conversation about this in the community? That's what really appalls me, really, is the one level, it's the way we're talking about other human beings and their lives and their who they are is quite frightening, and I don't like what I see in the Australian soul when I hear that conversation going on. It's not just the internet.
Greg Lake, you're a man of faith as well as a man of practice in this area, and you've been a part of creating policy in a prior life on a couple of different occasions. So how does your faith intersect with policy creation, and what can we learn from the outside in learning to connect with the policymakers in a useful way?
Look, yeah, one of the challenges that I've found working within the public service and developing advice from both an operational experience or operational experiences that I had, and also working in policy development areas in the department, was an ability to actually influence policy from within that position is only so great, especially as a Christian, where those policy statements by government at the time, the Labor government, around deterrence and the way that people arriving by boat are treated, came in direct conflict with that faith of mine. That Jesus that Michael speaks of died for people made in God's image and inherently valuable to God. What that means for me is when I'm on Christmas Island for the boat crash in 2010, I'm mindful that the 50 people dying are people that God deeply cares about. And so a policy which says we should just welcome people with open arms, whether they arrive by boat or not, if that creates an incentive to get on a boat, is a deficient policy. But equally so is a policy which uses human life as a deterrence to say it's better for you to be back where you came from, where you're fleeing from, than coming to here because of the conditions we'll subject you to. I won't admit, or I won't suggest that this is easy. But I do, I don't think Christians are all going to vote the same way at the end of a discussion like this. I don't think Christians should. I think we've got brains and we can disagree, and that's appropriate about things. And I think there are Christians across all political persuasions who can at least align behind those ideas that humans matter. And until we're presented with a political and a policy solution to this, which acknowledges that on every level, we can be dissatisfied.
Ada from Lidcombe.
I'm a Christian, and my question is, what is something that I and other Christians can do on a practical level to influence the political sphere concerning immigration policy towards the humane treatment of asylum seekers and refugees?
And we were just speaking about the Love Makes Way campaign. We have with us in the room this afternoon Matt Unslow from Love Makes Way.
I think what Michael said before, earlier in the program, about the fact that there is a reciprocal relationship between community attitudes and community values on one hand, and on the other hand, politicians and the design of policy. And the one affects the other, and the other affects the one. And, you know, that kind of goes around in a circle like that. I guess the logic behind something like Love Makes a Way and our particular approach to civil disobedience is not to say that people on the other side, our opponents, which is a pretty strong word. Our approach is not to say that, oh, they're all terrible people and we're the good people. And if the terrible people were more like us, then wouldn't the world be better? I mean, how ridiculous. Part of what we do in our prayer vigils is to admit that we're part of the problem and that the community itself, the attitudes that we hold, are part of the problem. I freely disagree with Mr. Ruddock about their approach the government is taking, but I hope that we could have a beer together, or something like that. You may not want to, that's okay. But
I was brought up as a Sydney Anglican when they wouldn't allow you to drink.
Well, then we can have a juice. My hope is that this creates a possibility for conversation, but we know that at the moment it does not. What our hope is that we can provide a platform for people to be able to say, this issue has become so bad. And while there are good people in the government, the sum of the parts has led to a situation where our government is doing things that we strongly disagree with, and we believe that strongly that it is causing harm for people, especially children. And that we have to be disobedient. Our conscience leads us to that point. And I take Michael's point that some people won't feel like that. And that's okay. There are lots of Australian Christians who currently feel that way and feel that we need to make a statement in order to show the government that there are people who will not stand for this, and also to show the community that there is this tension underneath all of our community. There is a kind of conflict that goes on, often unseen and unheard. And we're hoping that what we are able to achieve through our actions is, as Martin Luther King Jr. talked about, to unearth that tension and to show that injustice to the community for what it actually is. To get people thinking of it and talking about it from a different perspective, help them see the issue from a different perspective. Have we got traction? We've got the... I don't know, but I believe we do, because we've had so many church leaders not only join us, but also say, yes, what they're doing is right. I can't join for whatever reason, but I endorse what they're doing. We've had conversations with a number of politicians now, and we're seeing slowly the church begin to stir, not just from what we're doing, but hopefully we are a part of that, and we believe that we are.
Matt Anslow from Love Makes a Way, thank you for joining us. Philip Ruddock, if there's a prayer vigil outside your office, what does it do for you?
Well, I would talk to the people. I always do. I've always had an open door approach. That's not my problem. I am patron of an organisation called Neighbours and Friends. And it's an organisation that is about trying to work with people and asylum seekers, refugees, to play a part in settling those who are here. But I think these issues need to be understood in terms of the enormity of the problem that we face because of the numbers of people who came fairly recently. And it's going to be an issue that will be resolved, but it's not going to be resolved as quickly as we might like. I'm often given to making what appear to be flippant remarks. One of the problems that governments have in dealing with these issues is because the people who come don't book in. We have no idea about how many people are likely to be trafficked at any one time. And decision-making. I can remember when I was first responsible for these areas, the number of people trained to be able to make informed decisions about refugee status could be numbered on one hand. And it took a time before the bureaucracy was able to train up the number of people to be able to fulfil that task. It did lead to delays. The numbers of people you have on tribunals that deal with these issues weren't sufficient. The number of judges, and the judges end up complaining about the number of asylum claims that they have to deal with because of the size of the, and dimension of the problem. And it gets to the same in relation to how you detain people. I don't want to detain people inhumanely. But sometimes you don't have the accommodation. We built the Christmas Island Detention Centre and were told by the Labor Party that it was too big and extravagant. And then we found it wasn't large enough for the purpose. These issues do put particular demands upon government, upon the public officials, that are not readily understood. And I would welcome people if they would work with John Fry and Neighbours and Friends, because it is an organisation trying to get beside people and help them.
And so we come to what can we do? Let's put the rubber on the road here. Let's talk about these lives as individuals. How many can we take? How many should we take? And where do we start the conversation? With Kevin from Castle Hill.
What would be the practicalities of increasing our refugee intake? For example, if our intake increased to 25 or even 50,000 per year, what support would be required in terms of welfare, employment and accommodation? And how would this support be funded?
Philip Ruddock?
I mean, the support goes to all of the things that we take for granted. If people haven't got a job, you're going to put them on benefits. Access to Medicare, I imagine, you know, all of the expenses associated with giving people adequate health care. And then if you have people who've been traumatised, hurt, sometimes the costs associated with those things are even greater. I've dealt with the organisations that help victims of torture, we fund them to a very significant degree, but the workload that they face is of a very large order. Then you have accommodation. They don't come in the main with funds to be able to provide accommodation for themselves. Then you have a whole lot of other issues that arise. You get expectations of family reunion. The numbers that you think you might be going to get will end up being very, very much larger. If you actually look at the programs that the government has in place for supporting refugees, and they're the most expensive programs, teaching people English, dealing with the... getting them qualifications that might enable them to work and be employed. We're talking many hundreds and sometimes billions of dollars. And I don't hear people in a present budgetary climate coming to me and saying, we will take less of some programs in order to be able to do more here. We'll agree to a refugee tax to be able to pay for settling very much larger numbers of people.
Katie Wrigley.
Yeah. It's worth noting that to significantly increase our humanitarian intake does involve a financial commitment. I think the numbers that Chris Bowen last publicly released were around an extra 1,000 refugees over 4 years would cost in the region of $250 million. However, research shows that refugees actually benefit the economy because they're highly entrepreneurial. They fill important employment niches and gaps within the Australian workforce, and they're more likely than other migrants to stay in Australia throughout their entire working lives. There are also ways that we could reduce the costs of supporting refugees in Australia. For example, we could change our current policies so they don't create lifelong mental health problems for people. We could treat people more decently while they're awaiting an outcome in their case. We could let them volunteer, let them work, let them learn English, and then once they're granted a visa, we could allow them to reunite with their families so that rather than separating them permanently from their immediate family members, as would happen with temporary protection visas. And I think it's worth noting that Australia has ample capacity to significantly increase our humanitarian intake. We also, I would argue, have capacity to do both reviewing our humanitarian intake and also maintain a substantial resettlement program while also reviewing our current approach to asylum seekers.
You might like to share your research with me. Because my understanding is that while immigration is positive, skilled migration, family reunion is largely neutral, and that the humanitarian program imposes a significant cost. And the level of employment amongst humanitarian entrants is significantly lower. And one of the reasons for it is that if you are really dealing with refugees who've been tortured and traumatised, you can understand that they may have significant issues about getting into employment. So I'm not being judgmental in relation to that. But to argue that it's a positive economic benefit flies in the face of all of the research I've seen, so I'd be interested to see the research you're referring to.
Sure. Yeah, I can point you to the RECOA website, which details most of this research.
On the theme of employment, let's go to Tristan from Marrickville.
Hi there. There's been a few allusions tonight to capacity, and I'm glad we're discussing now what we can do as a community. I'm a financial planner and part of the small business sector, and I work with and I'm friends with a number of professionals who are passionate about doing something to help and don't know what to do. My question is directly, I guess, towards government approach, but also to anyone on the panel. What can we do as a small business community to help asylum seekers build a constructive life as part of our society?
Katie, we'll let you have a crack at that one first.
Yeah, so you could think about hiring a refugee or an asylum seeker with work rights to use their skills and give them an activity and a purpose while they're waiting or in the early years after they've been accepted as a refugee. Also, there are organisations like the Asylum Seekers Centre, which has an employment assistance program, so they work in partnerships with employers to connect them up with asylum seekers and refugees looking for employment outcomes. So they check with the department whether or not a person has work rights. They also usually interview an employer to work out the needs of the organisation and identify relevant job opportunities and then recommend suitable candidates that they provide training for.
Claire from Forestville.
As a Christian who works with children, the treatment of children seeking asylum is a subject I feel strongly about. I'm wondering what is being done to help children transition well into the Australian culture and deal with personal trauma.
Katie Wrigley.
Yeah, so RACS represents a really large number of unaccompanied children throughout New South Wales and indeed throughout the country. It's been our experience that there are a number of services that provide welfare support to these young people, in the ones in New South Wales. So there's Red Cross or Marist Youth Support or others who provide welfare support to these young people, and they take great care to ensure that children have access to opportunities in the form of integration into the Australian community, like going to school or meeting regularly with community leaders, weekend local sport and those kinds of things. Like RACS, those organisations also have referrals to services that deal with victims of torture and trauma. I think that in our experience, what our clients tell us they need is that they need to know that they're safe, and that's really standing in the way at the moment of them fully integrating with the Australian community. They are wanting to know what their status is in Australia. They're wanting to know, will they go to Nauru or PNG? And at the moment, as their lawyers, we can't answer any of those questions for them because we don't know. And I think Australia should not be responsible for damaging children who are seeking our protection, and the uncertainty of those answers to the questions that they are asking us is currently damaging their mental health. RACS opposes the use of remote locations for detention for families and children for any length of time, particularly for unaccompanied children, and transferring infants and children offshore is unnecessarily punitive. Infants and children should be afforded their basic rights of freedom, healthcare, education and play.
Greg Lake, you recently testified at the inquiry into children in detention, and your testimony went to the nature of selecting some children to make a point.
Look, the conditions for kids in any detention centre is always going to be difficult. The minister, who also appeared before that inquiry, made some very, I think, positive comments about his need and desire to see children removed from detention. I think we as a community need to hold him to account on those comments by saying things like, if you're going to claim a political win for having achieved a stopping or at least a slowing of boats, then the deterrent advantage of continuing to hold children in detention on Nauru is no longer acquired. And so if the reason why we haven't removed kids from detention already tonight is that we're slowly unpicking that aspect of our policy, our deterrent policy, so that we can maintain this boat stopped status, well, the boats have stopped. You've done it. Congratulations. Take the kids out.
Can I just take a moment to say I want to see children treated humanely. It is not a business of trying to essentially punish children. I am alarmed that some people think that if they put their children onto boats and the sort of voyages that many have taken, that that is an appropriate way for them as parents, hoping that they might be able to leverage that later for themselves to treat their own children.
Our last question is a doozy, and it's to each of the panel. Troy from Blacktown.
So all of you on the panel are for asylum seekers in your own way, and that's a position that I also identify with. But I think often with refugee advocates, there can be a lack of real clarity in terms of what we're really working towards. So if you were to design and implement the asylum seeker policy that you wanted, what exactly would it look like?
Katie Wrigley.
I think an ideal policy would accept that there's really no solution out there short of ending peace, ending all worldwide conflict and achieving peace, love, and understanding across the entire planet. That's just accepting that's not going to happen in the near future. Rather, I think our response should focus on finding a way of managing the issue in our region that treats asylum seekers in a fair manner, while recognising that we can only protect a tiny proportion of the millions displaced around the world. So my ideal policy would use common sense, generosity, and pragmatism to recognise that what we're doing now isn't sustainable or long-term and isn't creating durable solutions for refugees in our region. An ideal policy would acknowledge our legal obligations under the Refugees Convention, including the detention clauses, and would commit to a fair, transparent and efficient refugee status determination process. An ideal policy would look at what's sensibly within our power to prevent or stop deaths at sea, but if people reach Australian territory, an ideal policy, and under international law obligations, their claims to asylum should be processed, and if they're found to be refugees, they should be granted protection.
Michael Jensen.
Well, I don't make policy, I'm a theologian. so that's the politician's job, but what I want to see is a better conversation. I want to see language used that doesn't condemn people and doesn't demean people. I want to hear a better conversation about it, and I want to hear leadership from government about this, not pandering. That's what I want to hear that. I want to hear leadership which actually uses language which is gracious, even compassionate, in such a way as leads to a change of heart in Australian people. That's what I'd like to see.
Philip Ruddock.
Thank you. Can I just say that for me, ideally I would want to change the world commitment to the Refugee Convention. I mean, we have a convention which a limited number of countries are parties. A small number of countries are resettlement countries. And we have a lot of shifting of burdens. I would like to see it where it is fair and shared. I also don't want to see, let me say this very clearly, a reopening of people trafficking. Because all of the problems that we are talking about of children and management of their circumstances derives from the nature of the people smuggling business, the large numbers of people that have been brought here, and the management of that is extraordinarily difficult, and I don't want to see a situation... If we continue in time without boat arrivals, the problems that we talk about, I think, will be fairly quickly resolved and we'll be able to move on.
Greg Lake.
I think the policy response has to have a diplomatic element. So it's in some ways to echo what you've just said. I suppose it needs to look at the question of how do we actually address the new refugee, the person who fled recently, and what are the circumstances of current conflicts and current displacement that we need to address in policy terms. And that might look very different from our existing refugee and humanitarian program, and we might need a new program as a result. The language thing is critically important to me, and I think governments actually speaking with very sometimes bland language is important, but I also think we need to recognise that politicians are ultimately politicians and they have an obligation to win elections in order to get the stuff they believe done. So it's not just on them. The language thing's not all... It's not the politician's fault on their own. It's all of us collectively, and I wouldn't suggest you were saying that, Michael. I do think that we can be a lot more strategic around our resettlement in Australia and use ourselves and our own example, which we can control, as the flagship model. If it costs $250 million for an extra 1,000 people, we could bring in an extra 10,000 people on those numbers and make quite a dent in the number of people who are in transit in a place like Indonesia right now, and it would still cost nearly $1 billion cheaper than it costs to run offshore processing.
That's former Detention Centre Manager Greg Lake wrapping up selected highlights of our live Q&A on refugees and asylum seekers. Now to an asylum seeker. Bashir Yousufi's family were harassed, persecuted and threatened with death by the Taliban in Afghanistan.
At 14, he fled the country, making his way to Indonesia and then by fishing boat to Christmas Island. At the time of recording, he was preparing for his HSC and had recently been selected as vice captain for his school. When we connected with Bashir on the school bus on the way home, we started with his family life back home in Afghanistan.
We are from Hazara ethnics, and we've been persecuted in the last 13 years. And my father was killed by the Taliban, and I was 14 years old, and I was forced to leave the country at the age of 14.
How did you, as a 14-year-old boy, without any family with you, make it all the way to Indonesia?
My uncle just took me to the border of between Afghanistan and Pakistan in 2010, the beginning of 2010. And he left me, and he said, okay, you, from now on, you are on. From Pakistan to Indonesia was by plane. Well, the smuggler, we have to pay for it, and so they have to organize everything. So that was from Thailand to Malaysia was by plane, then from Malaysia to Christmas Island was by boat.
When you made your approach to the smugglers, how did you find out who could get you on a boat, and how much did that process cost?
I approached the customer by the smuggler by hearing from the people who are going to the same journey as I was going.
Yeah.
And I hear from them, and then I got the number from them, Evan, and then he said, okay, I'll take you, and then you have to give me the money. And I said, I don't have money to give it to you, I'll be very honest. And he said, how much do you have? Whatever you have. So I just only give it to him, like approximately like $2,500. I'll give it to him, and that's the only money that I had.
Bashir, what did they tell you would be the process once you got on the boat? What promises did they make to you about your ability to be able to come to Australia and stay here?
The only thing they said, it will take you 24 hours to get in Christmas Island from Indonesia. It's a short way and blah, blah, blah. And I was believing on him. And then for a certain time that when I got on the boat and when I went there and I was sick, and they said, Evan, you know, the smuggler promised us this. I bought a water, food for 7 days, blah, 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 and you guys don't have to buy anything, any single bottle of water, and everything is ready. So I didn't even buy anything.
So yeah. You must have realized pretty quickly that wasn't going to come true as soon as you got on board the boat, yeah?
Yeah, as soon as I got there, and then I realized that, oh, okay. So and then the people was trying to call him and then to tell him that what's going on. And then he switched off his phone, actually.
And what did they tell you Christmas Island was going to be like when you got there?
They were telling me, like, you are too young. They won't lock you in detention centre. They will, as soon as you got there, they will release you into the community. You don't have to be worried about it. And I was quite happy, actually. But when I got in Christmas Island, I went to in detention center, and I was in detention center for almost 1 year, and I was like, this smuggler, it just lied to me. It just absolutely lied to me. You know what I mean?
What was daily life for you like on Christmas Island?
The first things they've been told me that, okay, you have to share a room with other six kids. Okay, no problem. I will do that. And the daily life, every day, every single day was getting worse and worse and worse. You know what I mean? I was actually start learning English at the first month. Later on, and I said, for how long do I have to be in detention center? And for how long I have to spend my time in here? And there is no future and there is nothing. And what I'm going to do in here? So on that time, I was quite concerning, and I was questioning myself, for how long do I have to be here? And I wasn't able to remember things like English words to translate in my own words, and, you know, to learn English and all that.
Yeah.
But I wasn't able to do that. And thinking, like, how difficult was that you locked in a room with other six people, and you have no idea what you have to put your clothes, your shampoo, or whatever you have, where do you have to put them?
It must have been a very lonely time for you.
It was. But the best thing was that later on, after a couple of weeks, I met one of my friends. And he's still, and even today, I'm living with him. We are together living. He's still together. From that day we meet until today, we are together. We're both together.
When you moved to Melbourne to continue the processing, how was that different from Christmas Island?
Was not much different. Christmas Island was a detention centre. Moved to Melbourne Detention Centre was also a detention centre. The same thing. Rules, regulation, everything was the same thing. There's not much difference.
When you went to Brisbane, and then you were released into the community, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, once I get my permanent residency and they said, okay, we will send you now to Brisbane, and there is an organisation called Life Without Barriers, and they will have a room for you, and they will you will share a house with them, and then you will go to school, and you will release. You no longer belong to detention center. You are no longer in detention center. So I was very happy. I was very pleased to release from detention center.
After having been through so much, getting to Indonesia, then the boat trip, then the detention centers. When did you start to realise that this was going to be your new home and really connect with the prospect that things were going to get better for you?
When the time that I was going to school was for 5 months, then after 5 months, I was able to speak English, and I was able to share my experience to other students, and I was challenging myself to the Australian kids. And since when I was there, and then after a while, I came to Sydney in 2012, and then I would look around, and I was speaking English, and I was talking with people, meeting people, and I was like, this is incredible, this is absolutely beautiful. You have no issue. You feel like you belong to this country, and you feel like these people care about your future, and these people is here for you to help you. And I felt like totally belong. You know what I mean? I found a sense of belonging.
That is fantastic to hear, Bashir. Do you have any family in Australia now, or are you still living on your own?
No, I don't have any family in Australia. I'm still living with my friend Mohsin, the guy who I met in Christmas Island. We're both still living together.
Yeah.
But my family is not here. My family is in overseas. I have just only three brothers, and they're also they are living with my uncle. That's all I have.
Have you been given any indication that they might be able to find a place here as well?
Well, I gave a couple of times, and the Department of Immigration reject my application for a certain reason. I have no idea what's going on, and they said you have to provide this document, you have to provide that document, and I'll provide the Afghani document and everything. I translated to English, and I lodged application and everything. But still, they said, there is no result. There is nothing is coming up. So I have no idea.
Much has happened since you were 14, hasn't it?
Much. I love every single Australian people, which is they welcoming me to this country, and they accepted my refugee status. And they said, you are now belongs to Australia. You are permanent residents to this country. In 2015, at the beginning of 2015, I will be Australian citizenship. I feel very, very excited, and I feel very. I love it. To be honest, I really love it. I spoke with some of my friends who is around me, and sometimes they're telling me like it's very difficult and it's very boring. But I was just telling them like do this, do that, do this. I was similar like you guys, and I was telling them go to church, study, or go to get a job. But some of them is do listen to me, and they did, and now they're coming up and the next days, and they come up to me and they said, Bashir, your plan was very positive, and now I'm doing a certificate 3 or 2 in the TAFE, and I'm busy, I'm learning and all that, and it's fun.
Bashir, it's been a pleasure catching up with you. Thank you for sharing your story with us on Open House Around Australia.
No worries. Thank you very much for following me.
That's Bashir Yousufi, who, by the way, intends on studying accountancy after his HSC, and we wish him all the best. We finish this podcast with Tanya Riches and her husband, Tim Shearman, and a song on this very subject, Welcome Home.
There is a place to this earth we came, naked we will go home. The place you carry deep within, the place that you believe in yourself. So come lay down your heavy load, welcome home. Cracking in the west, cicadas in the heat. You're lying restless on your bed. A holy sound, a holy sound. Listen in the dark, hear thunder.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.